You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm often asked what my favorite story is among all those I've ever told, and the truth is I really don't have a particular favorite. But if I had to name one of my top 10, the story Lost in the Mountains, which was podcast number 155, I recorded that about 2 years ago, that would definitely rank up there. Now, if you're not familiar with that story, let me just tell you, it's the incredible true story of 5-year-old Pamela Hollingworth, who got lost in the heavily wooded White Mountains of New Hampshire back in September of 1941. When she got lost, she was totally unprepared for what she was about to face. It would get below freezing each night, it rained almost every single day, and all she had on were corduroy bib overalls, sneakers, and socks. That's it. In what would be the largest search and rescue mission ever up until that point in the state of New Hampshire, thousands of volunteers scoured the mountainous area in search of her. And with each passing day, the chance of her being found alive seemed to diminish greatly. In fact, most of the experts concluded that she could not have survived. Yet miraculously, Pam would be found alive after 8 days in the wilderness. And she had lost a significant amount of weight, she had extremely frostbitten feet, yet she would make a full and complete recovery. I should tell you, I wrote that story while my wife and I were vacationing in a cabin about 20 minutes outside of Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania. As a result, the internet, it was incredibly spotty, and I was only able to stay online for minutes at a time. And I had already determined that Pam and her parents had passed on, but I was unable in my brief spurts of internet access to determine what happened to her brother Ted, who happened to be 9 years old when the incident took place. Well, to my surprise, this past Valentine's Day, I received an email from Ted's daughter Tori, and she told me that her father was indeed alive and well. And within minutes, she had put me in touch with him. So as a special treat, I thought it'd be interesting to have Ted not only tell his version of the story, but also to come on and let you know what happened to Pam after this incredible story faded from the headlines. So without further ado, let's take a listen to my interview with Ted Hollingworth as he takes us back into the woods. I am Steve Silverman, and this is the Useless Information Podcast.
Useless information.
So Ted, thanks for joining me today. I thought we'd start by you just telling a little about yourself to my audience.
Okay, well, I started life working with my father in the construction industry. So I became a field engineer after I was graduated from Dartmouth College. And I went in the military for my 6-year obligation. And I was in the 351st Missile Battalion, which is part of the Cold War, stationed in Cleveland. And then began, because of my experiences in the military, I became a public speaker for my battalion in the Cleveland and that area on North American defense. I began to get a taste for teaching. So when I went back to civilian life, my father suddenly died. My life changed. So to make long story short, I decided to go back to Boston and go to graduate school. Mm-hmm. It was a toss-up between Harvard and a PhD in history or a place called Emerson College and a master's degree in communication. And after about a 30-minute meeting with the chair of the Emerson department. I said, this is it. This is the guy. This is my thesis. Let's go. So I stayed with Emerson 54 years,
wow,
teaching a wide variety of courses and starting the internship programs, and I think probably in the country. And then I was teaching a lot of other places too. And Harvard picked me up in the extension school to teach a course in management, a new program and kind of an MBA program. And I taught there 36 years and worked with a lot of other colleges and then was recruited by the MITRE Corporation, which is a think tank.
Mm-hmm.
It's a spinoff of MIT. It's like RAND on the West Coast. It's a brain factory. It's 700 MIT grads and so forth. And stayed there for about 45 years. 19 of those years, I worked every summer full-time and then part-time during the academic year and so forth. But I did stay doing training for them after that, but then focus on Harvard and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I used to travel about 60,000 miles a year. And I had a top secret clearance, which was great because I got to work for 17 years with the man who broke all the Nazi codes in World War II at Bletchley Park, Gordon Welshman, and we became extremely close friends up until he died and so forth. So I've been very fortunate. I've had a lot of really amazing things happen to me. I didn't create them. I just happened to be there at the right time.
Of course, we have spoken before, and you're just giving a very brief overview of what you've done. It's just an incredible resume that you have. But of course, the real reason we're here today is because your daughter contacted me, your daughter Tori. She contacted me. I actually checked this morning. She contacted me on Valentine's Day and mentioned that I should get in touch with you to talk a little bit about your sister's story. And I recorded this podcast, I guess a little bit, probably about 2 years ago now. And it is one of the most popular stories I've done in recent years. So I'm just so happy you've come on to kind of tell your version of the story.
Well, it's a great story, Steve, in itself. I mean, I just happened to be the guy who was there and probably know more about it now. I think all the rest of them are deceased. But it's a staggering story, and I'm always happy to talk about it because of the story that it is. And I think when you hear it in a more detailed way, you'll realize why I feel that way.
Yeah. I mean, of course, everything I did was from the reporters, from newspaper accounts. So, you know, you have a real insight into it. You know, the newspapers like to put a spin on things if they can. So I hope I was fairly accurate in what I wrote, but I'm curious to see if there are mistakes I made or really to see what you can add to the story, because you know so much more than I can get from those print resources. So anyway, so why don't we start?
Sure.
I guess we should just set the scenario. This is September 28th of 1941, just a few months before Pearl Harbor is bombed.
Yes.
So why don't you take it from there?
First of all, it was very dry at that particular time in New Hampshire and in New England in general. And my father, my mother, my grandfather on my father's side, my grandmother on my mother's side, and my sister and I, we got into the family Chevy to take a drive up to the White Mountains to have a cookout. And the White Lakes area, as we got up there, because it was so dry, there was a fire hazard. So all of the public parks and all of the woods, you know, access to the woods and everything, they were, you know, verboten. You could not use any of them. They were blocked off.
Mm-hmm.
So we kept on going, and we came to a place called White Ledge Camping, picnicking area in Albany, New Hampshire, which is at the base of Middle Sister Mountain, which led to Mount Shikarwa. So it's right in that North Conway area, but there's a brook running down beside it, and the sign saying you can camp here, which meant you could have a fire, that you could cook your meal. So we pulled in there, and it was a small park. I would say probably maximum of maybe 35 other people there and so forth, some camping, some just stopping for a moment as we were there.
Okay.
Now you have to remember also another variable here, which is Pam and I lived in a very small country town called Dunstable, Massachusetts, with about 350 people. And our nearest neighbor was about a quarter of a mile away. Okay, so we were kids raised in the country.
Wanted to just quickly throw in, you know, because people listen from all over the world. I want you to say how far it is from Boston or something like
that. It's probably about 30 miles outside of Boston, maybe 35, 40, just below Nashua, New Hampshire. It was a very big town years ago, but New Hampshire kept splitting it up into different smaller towns. But again, about 350 people, our nearest neighbor about a quarter of a mile away, which means we were alone as children. So we were used to being alone, used to taking care of ourselves, well, very well trained by our parents about how to deal with water, how to swim, you know, how to find your way home, all of these kinds of things. So that, I think, was a very important variable as to as far as Pam's attitude when she was lost. And we were at this picnic place. And it was there was a brook running right next to this called Hobbs Brook, which was draining Middle Sister Mountain up there at the time. Now, at the time, Pam had a little fancy bottle that she wanted to fill with water. So I went down to the brook where she wanted to fill it. And, you know, she was very independent and very strong-minded. She said she wanted to fill it, so she needed to walk up the brook a little bit. And we weren't afraid of it. The brook was very mild, very easy. And I said, okay, you can see our car up here. You can see it at the top of the bridge. I said, that's where you go, because I'm going to go back. This is not unusual. She'd leave me when I'm down the brook, you know, back home or whatever. And so I went back. And everybody was quiet. It was around noontime. They were napping or reading. And so my mother and father, voracious readers. So I sat down to read something. And suddenly my father looked up and he said, where's your sister? And I said, well, she's just down the brook. She's just filling the bottle. He said, don't you go right down and get her. So I went down and I looked for her. She was gone. So I came back and said, she's gone, Dad. And what was amazing, within 10 minutes, there were 10 people looking for her. Okay. Within 30 minutes, there were 35 people looking for her. Everybody in that little campground was looking for her. Within 30 minutes, my father called the sheriff, the local sheriff, Taylor, and he called the Forest Service. He called the selectmen in North Conway. They called the fire department. They bring the fire alarms, you know, to call everybody to look. And within a matter of minutes, there were probably that evening a total of at least 50 people looking for her.
Obviously, this is the days before cell phones.
Yes.
So where was the nearest phone for your dad to call?
It's about 7 miles up the road.
Okay.
Yeah. And there was an old building there, kind of musty, and it became kind of a rallying point. They ended up moving it to the town hall in Albany because it became a very big operation, a huge operation.
And I guess we should mention that you were 9 years old and your sister Pam was 5.
I was 9 years old. She was 5. We both turned our ages that June. And again, as I say, and it's very important, both very secure in the woods, not afraid of anything. So it wasn't a fear thing. There was never any fear thing at all. Eventually, there were two governors involved, Governor Blood of New Hampshire and Governor Saltonstall of Massachusetts. Edith North Rogers, who was our representative from our district back in Massachusetts, was fabulous. She came up several times. She donated to the reward and she called in everybody. She called Basil O'Connell in Washington, who was the head of the Red Cross at the time. And he took all of his staff from Massachusetts and New Hampshire and sent them there and so forth. But there were sheriffs, CCC, fire departments, thousands from Lowell as volunteers, plus local volunteers, Army men at the time, enlisted men, the Red Cross, pilot named Wiley Apt, who had his own airplane, who volunteered to fly over and so forth. And one of the individuals who was a volunteer, his name was Clyde Stimson. And he said, I have a phone. It's about 7 miles from here. And what are your wife and you going to do tonight? And he said, well, we don't know. He said, well, come with me. And so he housed my mother and father and then me for a while for 2 weeks And one morning when it was very frosty, my father got up early, looked out the bathroom window, and he was on the top of my father's car wiping the frost off so he wouldn't feel bad.
Wow.
But the kind of backing that we got at the time, and just give you an idea, there were Army kitchens there, there were Red Cross canteens, there were local fire department kitchens, ladies auxiliary kitchens, the CCC kitchens, and so forth, just to feed the people. The Red Cross in one day doled out 5,000 cups of coffee as this thing really began to grow and grow. And the military was there, and they brought in all kinds of things. They had miners' lamps. They brought in the big spotlights that would, they were 500,000 candle power.
Sure.
So they could put them on at night so the searchers could find their way back. They also brought in a speaking truck, you know, a loudspeaker truck. So my mother and my father could drive through. They drove the trucks calling out, you know, Pammy, this is Dad. You know, if you hear people around you, go to them and help you and so forth. I guess it was heart-wrenching for anybody who just listened to the voice. You know, he spoke so much, you could hardly speak.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
So where were you while this was going on?
Now, that's an interesting point because it was a volunteer. We didn't even know who he was. At that first night, and he volunteered to drive my grandparents and me back to Massachusetts. And he did. He dropped off my grandfather-in-law, and he dropped off my grandmother and me in Dunstable. I actually went back to school.
Wow.
At the time, right? It was a 3-room schoolhouse. You wait for the bus, you know, and go up and so forth.
And when you went back to school, was everyone aware of what had happened?
They were aware of it. They had no idea, as we did not, that it was going to become such a big deal.
Right.
And so I think what the most fascinating thing to me was a number of people that responded and so forth, and all of the things that they did. Now, what I'd like to do is kind of read a little bit to you, if you don't mind, because I have a lot of this stuff written out.
Sure. We'd love it.
And it talks about, you know, the people coming in the CCC, and they were setting up, they've set up tents. They put up a tent city, you know, and the whole area there where she was lost, like that little park, became a living, breathing city. They had police officers to screen the people coming in. They had somebody assigned to the one spigot of water there to make sure that it didn't get it contaminated and so forth. And this just kept growing and growing and became, again, a bigger and bigger city. And it rained almost every single day. And they would get dozens and dozens of false leads. You know, for example, somebody said, you know, there's an ex-con up here and he's known for molesting children. And I saw him in the area. Well, the police would go, Massachusetts police in New Hampshire, they finally caught the guy actually in the streets in Boston, and he had a perfectly good alibi. But then they found out there's another guy up here and he's walking around and he's a former con. So the police brought him in and so forth. And then people would come in and contact and say, I saw a little girl down by the side of the road the other evening playing and so forth. Well, they moved the whole search over there. And they kept getting these leads that were wrong. And they were taking all of this, a lot of the searching to across the street. And my mother and father both insisted. I know Pam, they said, she would look for help if she got to the road. So she didn't just cross the street, so forth. But they had the army in there and the sheriffs and everything. They had the right to search every house within 4 miles. And they had airplanes going up above and anything that wasn't recorded. They got in, and the military would go in. They'd have guns, loaded guns, and they would go into these abandoned places and dig everything up and so forth. And they would send a mile of men through the woods, lined up on the side of the road at fingertip length, and go right up straight through the woods, so forth. But they had, again, all kinds of misleads. There was one other woman who gave them a lead and so forth. And they said, okay, we'll meet you in the hotel in the center of town. Little did she know, but every single man in that room was an undercover policeman. But it proved out she was wrong, so forth. But people would come and volunteer. You know, a couple of guys came in and said, we have a blind greyhound that can find anything. Of course, they were inebriated. So they kind of gave them a map and said, go ahead. Hours later, they said they were down the road, smoke coming out from under the dog, where they were dragging the dog along, and they were 7 miles in the wrong direction. But they did have some funny things happen. They had people up as high as 67 to 72 years of age looking. There was a guy named Fox from Albert Fox from Draycott, Mass. He was a farmer, he's 67. And then there was another guy. There was a Boy Scout. He was 15 years old. Okay. And there was one guy that I think he was a Boy Scout, and he cut his knee, you know, chopping through the underbrush. The underbrush was so thick, you couldn't get through it. They were finding traps that had been there for 100 years.
Wow.
From even the trappers lost them up there. And the people who lived on the other side of this territory, they covered about 10,000 acres of land. They said there were animals running through their yards, panic-stricken, because there was so much activity
sure.
on the other side of that mountain. You know, these kind of things were happening all the time. One guy I know had a heart attack, and he came from Lowell. I think my father took care of him until he died.
Wow.
Because I remember going to the tenements, which my father did on holidays, and bringing armloads of groceries and so forth, and going into this guy's apartment and seeing the two little girls sitting at the table having a cupcake for Christmas and so forth. And my father would leave stuff. Eventually, we did get over 5,000 letters. And it took my mother and her two sisters and her best friend over a year and a half to answer those, because they answered a lot of the letters. There were 5,000 letters, but they're 350 packages with books and dolls and cutouts, mm-hmm. everything else, which my mother and father donated completely to the orphanages in Lowell.
Sure.
But I think probably what we should get into this is what happened the final day.
Sure. So why don't you say how many days had gone by? We should also mention that it was below freezing multiple nights and raining.
Yes. As I said, she had a bib overalls on, corduroy. She had sandals with a strap across and socks, two blue ribbons in her hair, period.
Mm-hmm.
It went down to 21 degrees. That's not a frost. That's freezing.
Sure, a deep freeze.
The first night out, it got very cold. The second night out, it went to 21 degrees. And that's when everybody who knew the woods began to panic, because they said, the way she's dressed, she could never survive.
Mm-hmm.
And what she did, by the way, in retrospect, she would cover herself with leaves at night. And then she would, because she couldn't walk after it, probably the second night, as her feet froze.
Wow.
Okay. And when they found her, I can go through that in a little more detail here. Okay.
Sure. Whatever direction you want to take it is fine.
Okay. Well, again, remember it rained, you know, almost every day. And you had these dozens and dozens of organizations. And eventually, the estimate was about 6,000 people got involved in this search.
Mm-hmm.
And last weekend, they knew they were going to get a huge influx of people. So I'm going to read to you that final Monday. Monday, 6 October 1941, broke as a clear and mild day. At daybreak, the New Hampshire State Game Warden, Slim Baker, Major Franklin Spencer, Mr. Sanborn, Mr. Hollingworth, and two other searchers went straight to the spot where the footprints were found. The day before, they found her footprints, which was the first indication that she even was in the woods. This was the first tangible evidence to date that she was or had been in the woods at all. The ground was frozen. Slim Baker and Mr. Hollingworth crawled in on their hands and knees and lifted each twig off the prints one at a time. Mr. Baker examined the prints very carefully, then told the size of the shoe and the weight of the child. He even estimated the height of the child, because the prints led directly into a nearby tree with broken branches, which the person had evidently run into during the night. Later, it was found that this was the only time she had moved after dark. The entire remaining crew of close to 500 men could now be directed into that general area. The searchers worked back and forth through the footprint area with amazing speed and efficiency, despite extremely tough going. The underfooting was very poor and even treacherous due to the many days of heavy rain. But the early morning optimism wore slowly off as the search seemed to settle down into the same old routine with no more clues to inspire. As each crew reported in after covering their assignment, they were immediately sent again in the hope of covering all the ground possible before nightfall. Soon the sun began to sink lower and lower as the late afternoon shadows reflected on the faces of every man. Some gathered about in small groups as they returned to discuss whether or not they should advise Mr. Hollingworth to stop driving himself to death. But the large majority had decided to remain as long as they possibly could. The CCC boys were starting to put wooden floors in their tents in the case they had to remain far into the cold weather. The Forest Service personnel, the conservation officers, and some civil authorities had come to the unanimous decision that they would stick with Joe to the end no matter what. In fact, they all arranged to use up all their vacation time, sick leave, and holidays put together if ordered off the job. And if that didn't prove to be enough, those that did not have families decided to quit their jobs if necessary. How can you lose with, you know, morale like that? Meanwhile, far up Middle Cessna Mountain, about 2.5 miles from camp, a group of 85 men were then heading back towards camp. This group of CCC enrollees were under the direct supervision of District Ranger Charles Meade and Forest Guard Will Randall, Howard Bretter, Wilbur Thompson, T.J. Ramazza, and William Matson. The group was following along a trail parallel to Hobbs Brook. The boys were shouting the child's name, talking, and generally making quite a bit of noise. Ranger Meade blew his whistle, stopped the group, and stated that if the child was alive, she might yell, but they would not be able to hear her. He then asked to have 1 minute of silence. Quiet reigned for about 15 seconds, and then they suddenly heard, "Woo, woo." Everyone went almost berserk as they tore into the bushes. Matson and Ramazza, after about a five-minute frantic search, ran down to the bank of the stream. There on the opposite side, on her hands and knees, getting ready to crawl through the water towards the sounds, was what they'd been searching for over the past 8 days and nights. The time was exactly 5:05 p.m. on October 6, 1941. One of the men asked her who she was, to which she responded, "Pammy." "And what's your daddy's name?" "Joe. And I've been lost since Sunday." Now, immediately when they radioed that back to the base camp, the whole place was thrown into pandemonium. As soon as the announcement came over the loudspeaker system, everybody yelled and shouted and whistled, shook hands and cried and prayed and hugged each other. There were now just two big questions. How was she and where was Mr. Hollingworth? Mr. Hollingworth was off in the woods with another search unit when the news hit the base camp. Robert Toulouse, the Forest Service radio dispatcher, radioed quickly to this unit. "Calling Joe E.H. Is Joe E.H. with you?" "Yes." "Get this clear. Return to camp. We have good news." Mr. Hollingworth darted so quickly down the trail that no one in the group would even come close to keeping up with him. As yet, he did not know whether she was hurt badly or not. In fact, no one in the base had any idea. When he arrived at the camp, Major Spencer had a command car and driver all ready to pull out. Major Spencer, Mr. Hollingworth, and the driver tore down the road and right up the Middle Sister Trail with a four-wheel drive pulling the extremely maneuverable vehicle. They passed scores of cheering men who stepped off the trail to let the car pass. Within 10 or 15 minutes, they reached the rescue crew, and Mr. Hollingworth jumped out, picked up his little girl from a makeshift stretcher that the boys had made from birch trees in their jackets. "Hi, Pam." "Hi, Dad." "Were you scared?" And she said, "No. I knew you'd find me, Daddy." With that answer, Mr. Hollingworth lost all the horror of the entire event. And then it went into a pandemonium of celebration.
I can imagine.
And my father insisted on having everybody lined up and shaking their hand personally. And he got together with all the Lowell volunteers and said, "Now, all of you got to stay sober because this is going to be wild here tonight." Mm-hmm. So they had a lot of, you know, celebration and so forth. And the next day, it was all silent there. It was very silent. They just quietly kind of folded their tents and they said, the word at the time was they figured they'd experienced a miracle and so forth. But back in the Memorial Hospital, the news was released to her condition. She had two frozen feet, a frostbitten nose, scurvy around the mouth, and had dropped from 45 to 28 pounds. She refused to let her mother leave her side and insisted on having a light of some kind burning in the room at all times. In her sleep, she would wave her hands over her head as if pushing branches from her path. The doctors agreed to wait 24 hours to determine if her left foot had any life left in it. When Pam was found, her sneakers had to be cut off because both feet had swollen so badly. Her right foot was a puffed up mass of brown flesh with some blisters measuring an inch high and an inch and a half across in diameter. The toes could not be distinguished on either foot. The left foot was swollen even larger than the right, and it was a very dark, almost black color. Fortunately, after the 24 hours were up, Pam could, quote, wiggle her toes for her daddy. This proved that there was enough life left in both feet to eliminate the chance of amputation. And after that, another few, you know, scratches and scars, she was in remarkable good physical condition and in high spirits. She wanted an ice cream soda and, you know, scrambled eggs. Of course, they couldn't give her anything but broth for quite a while.
Were you there at that point, or was it still a few days before you got there?
Yes, I was shipped back immediately.
Okay.
So I was with my father all the time at the end. For example, we were on at the Stimson's house one night, and the whole front yard was full of reporters. And they said they demanded that they get a chance to take pictures. And they also demanded that they get to interview her. And my father said, absolutely not. And they said, well, okay, we're going to claim this was a hoax. And you did it so you could make money. And they had letters from different people saying that probably is what happened. He couldn't live. Well, he had letters also from the commanding officer and from the hospital and everything else. So he said, I'll tell you what I'll do. You elect one person to take a picture, no interviews. And I'll meet with you twice a day indefinitely at the hotel for briefings, which he did. And they let this one guy in, I even remember his name, and he took that famous picture of her in the bed and so forth. And my mother, you know, my father called my mother immediately when he got back to base camp. She was back in Lowell, Massachusetts. She was so struck by the news, she handed the phone to my aunt to verify it. So a friend called the Lowell police. The Lowell police came over and gave them an escort out of the city and then telegraphed all the way up to North Conway that she's coming. So in every town, they police waved them through.
Wow.
So they went out, state police and everything, they brought them through and so forth. But interesting thing, after that, a lot of things began to happen. You know, for example, my father was approached by people in Hollywood, Shirley Temple, so forth, to make Pamela books and cutouts and all these kinds of things. You know, this was during the Depression.
Sure.
So remember that money was a big deal at that time. I think the reward got up to like $2,500, which was probably a year's pay for most of the people.
Sure.
Around looking and so forth. And so my father had all this, you know, inundation of offers. So he went to my mother and he said, I've had all these offers, you know, we can make a lot of money. And she said, what did we pray for? And he said, to get her back alive. And she said, well, what did we get? And he said, just that. And he went out and turned it all down. They never got a dime out of the whole thing. They never did pay for anything. They couldn't have it anyway. So that, you know, kind of ended that. And actually, in my mind, I think really the most, of course, Pam was the key person in this, and that's the big deal. But my father, in looking back, was unbelievable in his commitment and leadership in getting these people committed to where they were putting, you know, giving up their jobs and putting, you know, stoves in the tents. And so they would stay. They were going to stay with her regardless and so forth. That was amazing. Another very key person was Edith North Rogers.
Mm-hmm.
She read it into Congressional Record, of course, and so forth. And it was considered then, certainly in the history of New Hampshire, the most amazing search with the outcome in the history. Probably one of the most, because a lot of these end up, you know, they find the person, but usually they're deceased, this kind of thing.
Do you think there was any discussion among your parents that maybe she didn't survive?
No, they were very open with me. We had a great family. We talked to each other. Okay. Well, my grandfather died, leaving my grandmother with three girls under 10, broke. And my grandmother had to work in the mills and the waitress on weekends. And my mother actually raised her two younger siblings because she was unusually, you know, mature.
Okay.
For her age and so forth. Now, maybe if they even had an inkling of it, they didn't talk to each other about it. And I don't think, I know my father wouldn't allow the thought in his head. So my answer to that would be, I don't think so.
Okay.
I have no evidence of that at all.
Yeah, because if you read the press accounts of the time, a lot of experts were saying too many days had gone by. It was too cold, too wet. There's no way a girl without much in the way of clothing, protective clothing, could survive. But they make it clear in the press reports that your dad was like, let's keep going, let's keep going, let's keep going.
Well, I remember in one incident, there was an older retired sheriff up there, and he got to talk to my father. He said, we ought to get bird dogs in here because they can smell human dying dead flesh. And my father turned and said, you know, I feel sorry for you. We're going to find her. She's going to be alive. So he wouldn't, the thought never entered his mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was that kind of a person, you know. when the city of Lowell had a waterborne drive to buy a destroyer, he'd be in charge, they'd buy two. He was the president of the community chest, you know, and so forth. He was a treasurer and president and treasurer for 25 years of the Lions Club, you know. He was a very committed civic leader, mm-hmm. very committed. And so I think that's one of the reasons that he had that kind of backing. You know, they saw him, they say, Joe's been, Tom Clayton, who was a broadcaster, said, you know, Joe's given a lot to this city. We need to help him out. That kind of thing. That actually received an enormous amount of coverage at that time. And I think without any question, what knocked it off the front page was the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. Because we still had reporters hanging around the house and things like that until all of a sudden the war took over.
One thing that the press did focus on was that your dad made a decision, your parents made a decision to move her out of the local hospital in Conway and take her back to Lowell. So can you expand a little bit on that?
Yes, she was in the Memorial Hospital in North Conway when they took her. Actually, when, remember, they came down the mountain on the Jeep with my father holding her. He passed her to my uncle. He said, you go to the hospital with her. I've got to call my wife, the Blanche, which he did. And so she was in the hospital there. And again, we can see there are a lot of reporters from all Pathé News, RKO News. You know, I'd run into kids at school and say, oh, I saw you in the movies last night or something. Yeah. And it was a huge amount of press. So when she got to the point where she was, the feet were okay, they knew they were going to save the feet, we decided, or my family decided, of course, to move her from North Conway to Lowell General Hospital, which is where we came from. Now, the question was, how do you get her out of there without getting inundated with the front lawn covered with, I say, news, RKO, everybody else out there? Mm-hmm. So what we did was, what they did, is sneak her down into the cellar and then get her to a back door that nobody really paid attention to, put her on the floor, back floor, and put a blanket over her in the car, and then just drive off.
Wow.
And my father left a letter to be read by the chief, you know, highest ranking person at the hospital, to all of them, explaining what they did and why they do it. You know, this was your child, you do the same thing, this kind of thing, and so forth. But he said, don't read it until we've had an hour's head start.
Sure.
But then they showed up, of course, at the hospital, you know, they were there and so forth. And actually, when the war broke out, this was, I can't remember exactly how many months it was after Pearl Harbor, the Treasury Department came out to Dunstable with all of their paraphernalia and everything to have her make a pitch for buying war stamps. Yeah. So it was still there.
And your parents still had no interest in having her do that then?
That they said, sure, she could do that.
Oh, okay.
For the war effort. She did it all dressed up and say, buy war stamps or something like that.
Sure. I guess I should ask, did she have any long-term effects of this? I mean,
that's another excellent question. And the answer is really surprisingly no, except for the fact that her favorite vacation place was on the Cape, and the mountains were not a favorite place to go for a vacation, although she didn't fear them. She didn't fear anything and so forth. But she kind of liked, she might have liked it anyway. Okay. So I assume that maybe subconsciously she said, well, I'd rather go to the ocean than go to the mountains.
Did your family ever go back there afterward, or they just stayed away?
That's a very interesting question, because I don't think even Pam was avoiding it. The irony of our family was that my very close cousins, my mother's sister, two of the tightest sisters I've ever known in my life, mm-hmm. My cousin was in line to become, you know, one of the executives at New England Telephone.
Okay.
They'd already moved him to Boston and, you know, groom him. He was bored, so he sold everything. His father almost had apoplexy because he was a depression guy. And he went up to North Conway and he got a bottle gas company and a Sears Roebuck franchise, met a woman out skiing. They fell in love. They got married, sent us a postcard, were married, and went on to be incredibly successful.
Mm-hmm.
Her son was the strength and conditioning coach for the Boston Bruins. He's now head of the Bruins Foundation and so forth. And they're in North Conway.
Wow.
And you look out of he just put a couple of apartment buildings there, and my cousin still owns a lot up there. And there's Mount Shikarawa.
Wow.
Right there. And I can say, that's where she was found. I can point to it.
This is going to sound like the craziest question, but when I was done with the story, there was a little mention that her shoes were in a museum, and then it was sold off. Do you know what happened to those shoes? That's all. It sounds like the craziest question.
That's a great question, because I.H. Morse owned a shoe store business, and his son and the son's wife were very good friends with my mother and my father. And he was a big game hunter. And so he wanted to build this museum with all of the things that he had collected when he was a big game hunter. Like he had a solid gold door knocker that he got from the King of Siam, you know, at the time, you know, now Thailand and so forth. And he wanted her sneakers, you know, the sandals that were cut off her feet and put them under glass and so forth. And so they were there. For years. And I read in the paper one day, because I'm into the antique and fine arts business, that there was going to be an auction up there. And I say, oh, sure, I know that. I've been up there, you know, and so forth. Something happened and I couldn't make it to that auction. So they were sold at the auction. I don't know where they went.
Yeah, that's a shame. It'd be when I was all done doing my research, for some reason, that one little question, what happened to those shoes? It just kind of stuck out in my mind, you know.
I think I still have the corduroy overalls.
Wow.
They're worn up at the knees, and I think so. And I still have the letters, by the way.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
I have a great big container full of, it's almost half full of letters, you know, and so forth.
That's incredible. I just kind of assumed they'd be gone.
No, I have them. They're in my garage, a heated garage. But my wife says, what are you hanging on to those for? I said, I don't know, but, you know, 3 cent stamps, you know, and so forth. And some of these, you know, letters were amazing. This a package came, it had a Hershey bar in it and an orange that was pretty well rotted by it got to a time to us. And it says, for the little girl who had no food. And it was as humble as that, all the way to a big, beautiful, you know, doll or something like that. I remember that first night when I was up there after she was found, the post office involved said, please, Mr. Hollinger, you got to run down here and get these packages. This was like a couple of days. And so we drove down. And as I told you, it was a Chevy sedan, four door with a big back seat and a trunk, packed full.
And cars were big back then.
They were big. And there was nothing. I mean, the trunk was full. The back seat was full. They were on my lap and so forth. And they just kept coming. As a matter of fact, I just got a notification from Smith College that one of Pam's surviving members of her class had donated money in her name for their alumni drive.
Wow.
And there used to be two of them. And I think one of them is deceased now. She was an interesting, very, very charismatic. She had electric blue eyes, and she could walk into the dullest party in New York and immediately would come alive. And she had friends that would be friends forever. So wherever she left, she always carried these, you know, friends with her. So she was very, very, very popular. Question I always ask is, did she never get married? And I always said, well, she had more proposals than anybody east of the Mississippi. But she was very picky. And she would think, well, this guy drinks too much, you know, or something like that.
Right.
She did date some. One of her boyfriends was from Basel, Switzerland. You know, he was about 6'7" or 8". And he had a PhD in optical physics, I remember that. And his father was the head of the communications for the Swiss Army when Hitler was going to invade. And guess who his father's roommate was when he was a young man in Paris? Picasso.
Wow.
So the house is filled with Picassos and Monets. But my mother and sister went over to visit them. This is after my father died. My father died at 58 from acute coronary thrombosis. Smoker, a heavy smoker. My sister died at 54, but she was a big smoker also. But they went over to my sister took my mother and went for a little tour of Europe because my sister majored in Italian when she was at Smith College, lived a junior year and worked, went to the University of Florence. She could speak perfect Italian. And they were over there at the house. And the shortest member of the family was 5'11", I thank the mother. All the counters were big up. My mother was 5'4". She said, it was like working with your fingers up in the air all the time, so forth.
So she studied Italian. What did she do with her life when she became an adult?
Actually, she was a really terrific actress. She actually went to New York with the idea of becoming an actress. But when she found out what you had to do in that business as a woman to succeed, she wouldn't have anything to do with that.
Sure.
She said she became the editorial director of the Arthritis Foundation, corporate communications director of Lane Bryant, first female.
Wow.
And they used to give out awards like $50,000 to several people every year, you know, for doing great things. And she would go and sit with the person 2 or 3 days and then write the articles on that. She was vice president for creative services for the Cancer Society, which she was the first female vice president of the American Cancer Society.
Wow.
And communications director of the United States Committee for the United Nations Children's Fund. So she spent about half her life in the for-profit side and the other half on the profit side.
Wow.
And the head of the UN at the time, we knew, and he was a single guy, and he would have her go as his escort a lot when they had big affairs because she spoke perfect Italian.
Mm-hmm.
She was a very successful New Yorker and was just getting interested in retiring. She was down at we bought a house together for our mother on the Cape. And the day before she was going to leave to drive back to Florida, she died. And she had an enlarged heart, and again, from the smoking. It was an absolute stunner. She died actually before our mother did, so it was really tough for my mother.
Yeah, I can imagine.
My mother died about a year later.
Now, how old were you when your dad passed?
My 20s.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember exactly how old. It was 1960, I believe it was, when he died. But it was an absolute shock. He was driving my mother and my grandmother, my mother's mother, and my cousin's grandmother for ice cream. And he suddenly said, "Blanche, I'm going blind. Take the wheel." She reached over and grabbed the wheel and brought the car over. And he'd had an acute coronary thrombosis right there.
Mm.
I mean, if you have to go, that's the way to go. But he's still very young. He looked great.
So I also wanted to ask you, you had told me there was a Gene Autry story. So I want to tell about that.
Oh, that's a great story. Thank you for reminding me. You know, this was probably November after she was found. And she was lost, of course, September into November. And we were back in Dunstable. And she was home. Okay, so we were back home and so forth. And my father got a call out of the blue. And say, "Hello, Mr. Hollingworth. My name's Gene Autry." And everybody knew who Gene Autry was at that time, and maybe even still do. It's surprising. But he said, "I would like to come and see the little girl who was lost. And now this is in California, you know, and we're on the East Coast. They'll show you the coverage this was getting. And so my father said, "Okay." But he was very leery. He thought it was a publicity stunt. So he said, "I'll meet you and when you come into Boston, and you can follow me back to Dunstable. So they flew in, and Autry with one of his buddy, Jimmy Wakely, who was also a great musician at the time, they came, and my father said, okay, just follow me. And he drove them all over the place through the town to make sure nobody was following, and nobody was. So he pulled into the yard, and I was there, and Pam was there. My mother had her all dressed up, and he came in. And they were two of the nicest men I have ever met in my life. Autry was fabulous. And he brought in a stack of records, probably a foot and a half high, of everyone he'd ever made. And he was known as the singing cowboy, you know. And he said, would you like me to sing for you? And she said, yes. And really, she's five. And he said, what would you like me to sing? He said, you are my sunshine. So he said, okay. And he was sitting on the couch. He got his guitar out. And he said, why don't you join me? So they both sang together, You Are My Sunshine, and so forth. It was absolutely wonderful. And then when he was leaving, he turned and he said to my father and to my mother and to Pam and to me, he said, my next rodeo in Boston, and he had a big one every year in Boston, you and your mother and your father and your brother are going to be my guests. And you're going to sit in my box in Boston, at Boston Garden. I'll send you the tickets. So they left. Japanese attack Pearl Harbor. 1946, we get a letter through the mail from Gene Autry with four box seats.
Wow.
And we went to that, of course. We went down there, and he was fabulous. Came out to meet us, took us to his dressing room, let her sit on the back of his horse, you know, Ollie. He was just great. And it was an event I never will forget in my life. And he didn't make one single move to get publicity out there. No photographers, no reporters, nothing. So I have huge respect for that man. And as you probably know, I was reading an interview with him years and years ago when he was in his prime. And he said, well, I'm not a very good singer and I'm not a very good actor, but I know numbers. And he was eventually one of the 400 wealthiest people in America.
Pretty incredible. And, you know, today he's not very well remembered. Probably he's best remembered for his Christmas songs like, you know, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and so on.
Yeah, that's keeps every year.
Yeah. They always say if you're going to record a hit song, it should be a Christmas song because it, you know, every year you'll get royalties from it.
That's right.
But yeah, I mean, he was a superstar in his day.
Oh, yes.
So it's amazing that he'd go out of his way and you know, he sees your sister before the war, and then 5 years later, the war is over, and he still remembers her and invites the family.
He remembered that. We were flabbergasted.
Now, did the family ever hear from him after that, or was that the last time?
No, that was it.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. Well, we made no effort either. I mean, you know, it was wonderful and everything else, but we didn't want to bother him.
Sure.
And I think he recognized we were just, you know, normal people, and he saw himself as kind of like a normal guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll just go on with our lives. This has been great, but it's over.
So I don't have many more questions. I do have one. Did anyone ever blame you? I mean, you went with your sister and you left her by the side of the creek and then she got lost in the woods. Did anyone ever blame you?
Not one single bit. As I was saying, you know, we were very confident. We're not afraid of the woods and everything else. He wasn't worried about her and the brook and everything else because he knew it was down. He checked it out and it was very shallow, that kind of thing. But he was concerned that, you know, shouldn't leave her there. Just go and get her. This is all maybe 50 yards.
Right.
Yeah. And so evidently what we figured out later is she went up the brook and she caught up a little too soon. And so there was some brush there and she probably walked within 10, 15 feet of where the family was.
Right.
They were all quiet because it was after dinner, you know, and they're reading newspapers and things like that. She just walked by.
Wow.
Ironically, the two people who went in that direction to look were my mother and me. And we just didn't go far enough.
As the years went on after this, did she think about it, or is it just something she put out of her mind? What do you think?
I would say that it did not bother her. Okay, we could talk about it. We could ask questions, which we didn't do very much anyway, because it was done and so forth. It wasn't a super happy process, a very difficult thing for my parents to go through. But every time it came up, you know, for example, here's something from the Boston Herald. This was the 25th anniversary. And this was, it says 6,100 found Pam 25 years ago. And then they have the picture here of my father, Pam, and my mother after she got out of the hospital. And that's her in New York City when she, 25 years later. These things would come out, she'd be interviewed and be talked to, and she was very calm and just factual, and she wasn't scarred by it, if that's what your point is.
Yeah, it's just an amazing story. Because I do come across lots of these stories because I'm always looking through old newspapers and stuff, and most of the time they don't end well.
They die. They're dead.
And I mentioned this to you when we spoke last week, is that I kind of came into the story in the middle. I just kind of stumbled across it and I didn't expect her to survive. I was just kind of pulling all the information together. It's like, wow, she lived, you know. It was not what I expected to happen.
Well, this is why you have the picture of me reading the Lowell Sun.
Sure.
6-inch headlines.
Yeah, I have that on my website. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that everybody was shocked. That not only found her, but she was alive.
Mm-hmm.
And that she recovered, you know, for 8 days and eight nights, down to 21 degrees, no food. But she stayed near the brook, which saved her life, because you can't survive very long without water.
Yeah, I just want to make an observation. You're 91 years old. Is that correct?
That's correct.
You were 9 years old when this happened. And I noticed as you read the account of your sister's rescue, when she was found, when your dad was notified, and now just now you still get kind of, you know, you can see your throat tighten up. It's still emotional to you.
Oh, yes. I'll tell you something interesting, and I may have told you before, but I've taught a lot of classes, you know, and I've taught one class I taught, I think, or taught 30 times at Harvard. It was very, very popular class. We got the, you know, Distinguished Teaching Award and everything else in it. And produce some amazing people like the president of Columbia, South America. You never knew who was in the classes in those particular days. And at the end, when my whole staff would do their presentations, and then I just get up, instead of giving a speech, which they all knew I could do that by this time, I just said, I want to read something to you. And that whole room of up to 90 people sometime from every culture you can imagine all over the world, and with, you know, some PhDs, some doctors and researchers, not everybody, but a complete spread of the whole human spectrum at that particular time. And that room would become dead silent until I finished, and it was still silent when I stopped. I mean, they were just like as wrapped up in that as if they were in the search, just reading the last half of the final, you know, chapter and so forth. And everyone which that talked to me said, that's the most incredible humanistic story I've ever heard, regardless of where they came from.
Yeah, it's an incredible, incredible story. I have to say, when I was done writing it, I was thinking, this would make a great movie, you know?
Make a great book.
Yeah.
Because movies, they mess them up, as you know.
Sure.
But I would say, you know, I've chastised myself for years that I haven't, you know, I'm good at reading books and I'm good at editing other people's stuff. For me to have the patience to sit down and do that kind of concentrated work is just not my kind of thing.
Well, Ted, I just want to thank you for being so generous and telling this story. It's one of my favorites of all the podcasts, the stories I've written in the 30 plus years I've been doing it. It's one of my favorites. And I'm just so happy you're willing to come on and share your telling of it, to share it with my audience. And I do appreciate you doing that. So thanks.
Thank you very much, Steve. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And I'm delighted to see that you've kept that, I think, a great story alive.
You're very welcome. Well, I guess we should say goodbye. So let's say goodbye. Bye.
Goodbye. Ciao.
Well, I do hope you enjoyed listening to my interview with Ted Hollingworth. I should tell you that I spoke with him for about 4 hours over 2 different days, and I enjoyed every single moment of it. Now, I should mention that my telling differs from what Ted and I just discussed. Not that the facts are any different, but I focus more on the day-to-day events that led up to her rescue. So if you haven't heard that, I encourage you to go back and listen to it. I'll remind you again, it was episode number 155, and I titled it Lost in the Mountains. If you have enjoyed this episode or the podcast in general, I would appreciate it if you could share it with someone. You know, that can be through Reddit, Facebook, Twitter, or like, I guess that's X now, or by whatever means you think will help grow my audience. Anything you can do to help spread the word would be greatly, greatly appreciated. Just a reminder that you can find the Useless Information Podcast wherever you get your podcasts, so be sure to subscribe. The Useless Information Podcast is now part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network, so be sure to visit airwavemedia.com, and there you will find a curated selection of some of the best podcasts, not just in history, but also in science, wellness, education, and the arts. As always, thanks for listening, and take care, everyone. Bye.
Hi, I'm Neil.
And I'm Ken.
And we are from the Triviality Podcast, a pub trivia-style game show where a lack of seriousness meets a little bit of knowledge.
Join us each week for an hour-long game of general knowledge trivia featuring special guests from around the world, plus tons of extra themed episodes.
If you want to improve your trivia game,
or you just want to scream at us in your car when we get easy questions wrong,
then we're the show for you. Find Triviality on all your favorite podcast apps.
But you know that, because you're already listening to a podcast.